Hello and welcome to Levitard and Friends Presents South Beach Sessions. Dan is on assignment. Well, Dan's on his honeymoon. I'm Mike Ryan. I help produce these South Beach Sessions, and today we got a good one from the world of cinema. You may know Jay and Silent Bob. They were iconic pop culture figures in the 90s and the early to mid-2000s. Well, they're back, and Jason Mewes, who plays Jay from Jay and Silent Bob, is here on behalf of Jay and Silent Bob's reboot. That is in theaters October 15th, and to find a theater near you, go to fathomevents.com/reboot. Film title's on the nose, and I like it. So Jason Mewes will be joining Dan in just a second, but I do want to tell you about our great sponsor that makes all of this possible, as well as all the other programs here on Levitard and Friends, ZipRecruiter. Hiring is a slow process. Cafe Alturo's COO, Dylan Miskiewicz, needed to hire a director of coffee for his organic coffee company, but he was having trouble finding qualified applicants. So he switched to ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them for you. Its technology identifies people with the right experience and invites them to apply to your job, so you get qualified candidates fast. Dylan posted his job on ZipRecruiter and said he was impressed by how quickly he had great candidates apply. He also used ZipRecruiter's candidate rating feature to filter his applicants so he can focus on the most relevant ones. And that's how Dylan found his new director of coffee in just a few days. With results like that, it's no wonder 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. See why ZipRecruiter is effective for businesses of all sizes. Try ZipRecruiter for free at our web address, ZipRecruiter.com/beach. That's ZipRecruiter.com/BEACH, ZipRecruiter.com/beach. With that being said, let's get into this week's interview with Jason Mewes of Jay and Silent Bob fame here on South Beach Sessions.
Those of us of a certain age have loved a period of time in Kevin Smith movies over a decade, and this guy was at the center of them as Chasing Amy and Jay and Silent Bob got going in the pop culture zeitgeist. Jason Mewes is Jay from Jay and Silent Bob, and the reboot is in theaters October 15th. If you want to find theaters near you, you go to fathomevents.com/reboot. I loved how they were able to do things early with what were obviously very small budgets. And Jason joins us now. I appreciate you doing so. It has been an uncomfortable journey for you, like through all of these films. So thank you for making the time for us. I'm curious, as you look back to the very beginning of the film journey, what do you think would have happened from there? What were you thinking the career path would become?
Kevin and I met, I was 13, he was 17, grew up in the same town. We were friends. I helped him at the Quick Stop where Clerks was shot. He used to say, hey, I think you're funny, and so does our friends Brian Johnson, Walt Flanagan. If you guys know him from Tom, Steve, Dave podcast and also Comic Book Men, we all grew up in the same town. He's like, I think you're funny. I wonder if someone in L.A. thinks you're funny. Wonder if someone in Portland or Chicago. Wonder if other people think you're funny, your weird sense of humor. Or is it just us Jersey guys, the Jersey humor? And he wrote Clerks, and he said, hey, man, I'm writing this script. I want to be a writer. I want to be a director. I'm writing this movie. I'm going to make it myself. And I wrote a character based on you and who you are as a 13, 14, 15, 16-year-old. So we shot the movie. I was like, yeah, whatever, bro, because I didn't plan on acting. By the time we shot Clerks, I started roofing. I put roofs on houses. We shot at nighttime. When the movie was done, it was tough for me to get through. I was super nervous. I'd never been in front of a camera. Even though I was saying and doing things I've always done, all of a sudden, I used to do stuff for my own entertainment and do it for myself. And now all of a sudden, people were like, with a camera going, do this now, say this, dance in front of the store now. And so it was odd. But finally, we made it through. My point is, even after that, though, I went back to roofing. Kevin edited, went to Sundance, was doing his thing. I didn't know anything about movies and the process and what happens. You try to get them sold if you make them independently and stuff. So I didn't think anything about a career. I didn't think about acting or anything. Clerks gets sold. Miramax buys it. Kevin says, I also got a 3-picture deal. I'm going to make a movie, Mallrats. I got offered, and I'm writing our characters in there again. And even still, I kept roofing, thinking whatever. It came down to us going to Minnesota, and we made Mallrats. After Mallrats, I was a little more comfortable, but I still didn't think, hey, this is what I want to do. This is a career path, possibly. I just was like, I want to get, this is so much fun. I'm having a blast. I can't imagine when I get home, I have to start roofing again in humid summer and cold winters and stuff. While I was there, I got offered to do an independent movie called Drawing Flies by a director named Malcolm Ingram, who was on the set for Film Threat magazine. So I went to Vancouver and did another movie. So now I've done three movies. That's when it started being like, well, wow, man, I've done three movies and I didn't even plan on it. Maybe this is something I can do. But when I got home, I still had to deliver pizza and do construction. Then I did Chasing Amy, which was only one scene. So it's not like I got rich or anything. I had to still continue to work. It wasn't until we left to go do Dogma. That's when I like started being like, wow, this is my fifth movie, and I really want to do this. I don't want to roof anymore. I don't want to deliver pizza, and I really want to make a go of this. But it's also around the time that I found the love of drugs. Now I'm like fighting with, hey, this is maybe something I could do, and this is drugs and stuff. So it was never something I planned, and I didn't plan on it even after the first movie, second, third movie. It really wasn't until Dogma that I was like, wow, I really am enjoying doing movies, and that's some credits under my belt. And this is every time I do a movie, I have so much fun, and it's so much better than delivering pizza and putting roofs on houses and stuff. So, I mean, that's sort of just when I wanted to do it. And you know, it was a struggle because then I was also fighting with drugs. But then I like got sober and I did another independent movie called Vulgar. And then that's when we did Jay and Silent Bob. So I started to get sober for that. It took a while before I planned on it, and I never really thought of it as a career path until, like, you know, movie number five and stuff. And that's only because I'm like, well, I've done five movies. There's people out there who haven't done any movies who want to be an actor, actress, what have you. So I'm hoping this will help me push off and do some more movies and get some more opportunities. So
you mentioned started to get sober. Wasn't that a condition of Kevin Smith's to do Jay and Silent Bob?
It totally was. It totally was. So by then, at that point, I was pretty messy. It was even before Dogma. So, but around Chasing Amy is when I started using. I wasn't full blown, and like Kevin didn't, he knew, but he didn't know. And then he found out, and he's like, you know, we're about to go to Pittsburgh and shoot this movie. You need to get sober. And I couldn't leave Kevin's side for about 2 months before Dogma. I went out with him when he went to do tech scouts and meetings and all location scouts and all this stuff. And I had to spend time with him. That's why Kevin tells a story about how I memorized the whole entire script, which is a true story, because I literally would have to sit in the car while he was doing a location scout that would take literally like 5 hours. And I'd have to sit in the car. Or I mean, I could walk around with him, but I would sit in the car and just read my script, trying to make sure I memorized my dialogue, because I didn't want to mess up my dialogue, because he told me Alan Rickman was going to be in the movie, and I can't mess around. Like, he's a serious actor. He's British. You know, the British created acting. And he scared me into thinking, like, I got to be my best. But I had to get sober for that movie. And then, yes, by that point, it was more just like, hey, you got to be sober for this because they're going to insure you and test you. But for Jay and Bob, after Dogma, I relapsed. And he said, hey, I'm not making another movie with you unless you get sober. And that's when it became like a condition of it. And then same with Clerks. I relapsed after Jay and Bob Strikes Back, and I disappeared for almost a year and a half or so because I stayed in L.A. I met a girl. I was staying at her house. I went from rehab and left rehab to go stay with this girl and sort of disappeared. And then before we could do Clerks 2, it was like, hey, you have to be sober. And I had gone to rehab for 6 months. And I was sober for another 6 months. So I had about a year sober when we finally, you know, Kevin's like, all right, we're going to shoot Clerks 2, and I'm going to write us in there, and we're going to be in it and stuff. So, but yeah, it became like conditions on if I could do more movies and stuff.
Which was the hardest of the rehab experiences in your recall?
Oof, it was definitely when I went away for 6 months, because it was a situation where, I mean, they were all hard, to be honest, but in that case, I was court committed because I went and I had a warrant. I turned myself in. A, it was the longest I've ever stayed in rehab. B, it was a rehab where you didn't leave the property. At least most of the rehabs, even if they weren't the fanciest of rehabs, some were fancy, some were like really sterile hospital type rehabs. But most of them, you would get in a van and go out to meetings and stuff. So you'd get to see the world a little bit. This one was on a property you never left. You never left it. And it was literally an old psychiatric hospital that they turned into a rehab. So there was literally like cots. And that was really tough. Not to mention that in the back of my head, even if I ever got fed up and was like, I'm out of here, I can't take it, I couldn't leave because there was the law over my head saying, if you leave rehab, you got sentenced to 6 months rehab. If you leave rehab, though, you have to spend a year in jail. So that was really tough because there was always that fear of like, hey, what if my obsessive mind jumps up, which I did at one point. And luckily, my probation officer gave me a chance because I left, but I came right back. I like walked off the property and turned around and came back in. But technically, they could have put me in jail. But my point, that was really tough. But it was also, there was a few times where I didn't go to rehab and I did it cold turkey before we did it. And that right before Jay and Bob, I did that. I did it cold turkey and it took almost a month because I was not doing heroin. I was doing OxyContin, which painkillers, they say, is worse because it stores in your fat cells where it might take 10 days to get over withdrawals. I mean, you still feel not so good, but after about 10 days, the worst of it's over if you're doing heroin. But the oxys, I'm not even exaggerating, it took like 2 months before I physically, mentally could sleep, move, and felt physically okay. And I did it all at home, and it was really, really physically tough. It was really tough.
What was the height of it before that last one where you decide to quit cold turkey because you could get your... Kevin Smith is helping you keep your life clean, right? Kevin Smith, both in career and friendship, just personally, you've probably broken his heart a few times. The story of addiction leaves a lot of broken hearts in its path, and yet you guys have had the relationship grow, and he loves you. I think if I've got this right, you correct me, Jason, if I'm wrong, but didn't he have you in studio sort of talking through a director's cut, and at the time, you were barely able to do anything because you were on heroin during that recording session?
Yeah, like I started nodding out and stuff and falling asleep, and then there was like the commentary part where I like passed out, and then there was another time with the Jay and Bob press junket. He brought me to the press junket, you know, and you go to a hotel and it's literally like the whole floor of the hotel and they got like 10 rooms. And in this room, it's so-and-so and you sit down and like 10 interview people come. Then you go to the next room and you have a lunch break and then you do 10 more. And I got to like the third one and I just kept nodding out. They're like, we can't have him here. Like all these people are seeing him like falling asleep mid-sentence. And they sent me to rehab then. So that was another time here in California. So, but yeah, there was a few moments like that. But yes, Kevin has definitely stuck by and has helped me out because he would get me in rehab and he would help me bring me stuff and come visit me. And he was like the only one. And not only because he cared, but because my mom had passed by this point. And it's so anyway, he's been there. And then, of course, the idea of like, hey, if I get sober, I can make a movie and I can make money and I can start trying to get my life back on track. I was in rehab with a ton of people who didn't have that option. It was like, hey, I've lost everything. And if I get sober, I have no place to go when I get out of here, but I need to get sober. You know, so luckily there was that. And that did help me because it helped me want to get better each time and really try to stay the course. And again, it didn't always stay the course, but it was there, like I wanted it. So,
at its worst, what was the worst of it? Like in terms of what you were doing daily and the impact it was having on your life?
The worst was right after Jay and Bob. So it was like a combination. I mean, physically, I would say, I know at one point when after Jay and Bob, I went home, my mom passed away. I really sort of lost it. And at that point, and I just sat in my house and used. And I weighed about 195 pounds when I got home from Jay and Bob Strikes Back, because I know because I went to the doctor to get OxyContin. And so he weighed me. And then when my prescription was up about 29 days later, I went back and he weighed me and I weighed 158 pounds. So I had lost like 30 pounds or so in like 29 days, literally. So that was like one of the worst physical part, and I was a mess. But I'd say the worst in my life is when I was out I was staying with this girl, and me and her were using. We had an apartment, and we spent all our money, and we had like 2 months, and the landlord was trying to throw us out, and the heat got shut off, and the electric got shut off, and we'd use candles at night to see in the dark, and it was Christmas time, no electricity, no money. We went and saw the dope dealer. We just saved up enough money. We just had enough money to get so we physically felt okay. And I remember it's so crazy because the dope dealer gave us crack and heroin as a Christmas present. It was the best Christmas present at the time ever, which is so sad. But we went back to the apartment, and we lit the candles, and we're using. But because we had extra dope, because it was Christmas and we got a gift, we got pretty messed up. We both nodded out. And we both woke up to the couch on fire. The candle burnt down to the bottom, lit the couch on fire, and literally half of it, like, we almost burnt the apartment down. And, like, I grabbed this bucket because the bathroom was upstairs and there was no light. I used to pee in this bucket. And I literally grabbed the bucket and used the bucket of urine to put out the fire. And it was just a mess and disgusting. And it's sort of like, that's when I was like, oh my God, this has to stop. It's horrible. And that's when I went and turned myself in. And that's when I got my 6 months in rehab. And that's when me personally made the decision, like, this needs to stop. All the other times, it's like I wanted to stop, but I didn't go in the rehab and stop. And I didn't stop. It was like, hey, do you want to do this movie? Stop. Yes, I want to do it, so I'll stop. But this is where I mentally was like, this is so, so bad. I need to stop. I want to stop. I'm going to go turn myself in. Hopefully they put me in rehab, sentence me to rehab, because there was a possibility they could give me jail time. And the one guy wanted to, the DA or whatever it's called, the lawyer or whatever, talked him into 6 months in rehab. But that was the time. And after I got out of there that time, I had about 4.5 years sober. And I really did want to stop, and I felt good, and I thought I was good and done. And then I got kidney stones. They gave me a shot of Demerol, and it sparked that, like, ooh, I remember this feeling. And they gave me Vicodin to go home with, and I was taking it as prescribed. And that lasted for about 10 days, taking it as prescribed, and I noticed that each day went by. It was like, there's 4 hours, 4 to 6 hours if I don't take it. Even if you're an addict, if you take prescription as prescribed, you're not relapsing. But if you take it 2 hours, when it says every 4 to 6 hours, then you've relapsed. So in my head, I'm like, as long as I stick to 4 hours, but I found myself counting like 3 hours and 59 minutes, 4 hours, and then I would take it. But by day 10, I was like, 3 hours and 58 minutes. Maybe the clock's wrong. I could take it. 3 hours and 30 minutes. It's only 20 minutes short. It's not really count. And, you know, next thing you know, 14 months into it, I'm taking like 40 to 50 narcos a day. And that was right before this time. Then Kevin found out. You could tell we went to Vegas. He came up to the room, and I was literally standing in my boxers in the middle of the room, nodding out. Like, when I nod out, I'd stand up, and my body would start to fall, but I'd catch myself. And he sat and watched me for like 10 minutes, standing in the middle of the room, nodding out. And finally was like, bro, like, I thought something might be up, but I was hoping there wasn't. He was super bummed, super upset. And then I went and detoxed in a rehab for 2 weeks, got out, went to meetings every day, and now I have 9 years. But we started the podcast, which was a big help in the beginning. We started doing Jay and Silent Bob Get Old, and I would count my days. Hey, I have 6 months, 2 weeks sober. I have 8 months, 2 weeks, and I'd be accountable to everybody that would come to the show. And honestly, it was such a big help in the beginning because I would talk about it all the time, all my drugs, what I did, bad stories, using toilet water, pulling over in a car and taking a puddle water to try to use to break down the heroin to shoot and stuff. Like, stuff like that, I would tell those stories in a funny way on the podcast, and it was a big help. And again, we did that for about 6 years, 7 years. Maybe more, and now I'm at 9 years and almost 3 months.
Congratulations, and I hear it in your voice. This is something that you don't mind talking about because you, I imagine, like other people, are hoping that if someone hears you and finds some inspiration in the honesty of the story, part of the rehab process is to be honest about where your demons were. You mentioned that your love of drugs started around chasing Amy. What was the trigger? Were you not much of a drug user beyond smoking marijuana before chasing Amy?
Yeah, no. I mean, for years it was just marijuana and a little bit of drinking. Well, my mom was a dope fiend, and she sold heroin, and she contracted HIV. So I hated heroin. I hated hardcore drugs, coke, all that stuff. And I didn't want to be around it. I remember people offered it to me. I remember this guy one time, plain as day, it's so crazy to think now. I can literally visualize him offering me coke. And I was like, dude, no way. Like, I don't mess with hard drugs. But the trigger, it was, it's so goofy. I met this girl. You know, when you're younger, you meet somebody, a guy. I was working with the Sky Roofing. Him and I became best friends, and we hung out every day. We'd go everywhere together. Like, we'd go to parties, we'd go to the movies, and I hung out with him every single day. He met this girl and started dating her, and she had a best friend who was, at this point, no lie, she was like one of those girls that I was like, this girl's so out of my league, I can never get her. She's so beautiful. And the four of us would hang out, and we weren't dating or anything at the time, but we started to date. And then I found out that they were using heroin, and I didn't talk to, I was like, I can't be around that. That's, I cannot believe you guys have been like hiding this behind my back and all that. And I didn't talk to them for probably about a month or so, but I really liked this girl and I really missed my buddy and stuff. And I was like, you know what? It's my 21st birthday, actually. I was like, man, I'm 21. I really want to spend it with my best friend and this girl that I like. Let's go to the bar. I'm 21 now. I can go to a bar. They're like, nah, we're not going to do that. At this point, I didn't know they were full-on, like, strung out, like, addicted and stuff. They hit it pretty well for me. So they were like, but we're going to be honest with you. We want to spend time with you. You can get some beer and drink, but we're going to use, but we won't do it in front of you. We'll do it before you come over. So I came over. They used already. And they were sitting on the couch, and we're like, I'm, like, drinking, listening to music, being like, come on, man, let's go do something. Let's go do something fun. I'm 21. And they're like, nah, man, we're just going to stay here. And I was like, I don't get it. Like, I don't get why you like that. Like, you're just, it's no fun. You're all falling asleep, burning yourself with cigarettes. Like, and they're like, you don't understand, man, unless you feel the feeling. Like, you just can't understand how good it feels and what it's like. And I was like, whatever, dude. I was like, you know what? Let me get a little bit. Let me see how good this is. And actually, I did it. And me and that girl cuddled. We made love all night, and it was, like, the most amazing thing. And it sounds so goofy, but it's true. It's the way it felt. And I'm sure that, you know, genetically, my mom was addicted. My sister's addicted. My brother's addicted to opiates. So right away, I loved it. I fell in love. But I didn't do it then. I still didn't want to get addicted, and I said I would never use needles. That was my rules. I was like, I'll only sniff it. And that lasted about 6 months. Or so, where I do it like only every other weekend, then it was every weekend, then it became every few days, and then I physically became dependent on it. But I won't use needles. I don't know how much time passed, but I remember that the difference was you'd have to, like, if I didn't have a lot of money and I could only get 2 bags or whatever of drugs, I would have to sniff 2 just to physically feel okay. My buddy kept telling me, like, well, if you do it, you know, you shoot it, it goes straight to the bloodstream, and it doesn't break down and all that stuff, so you only need, like, a bag. And I remember I was really, really sick, like 2 days passed, and I was super sick, and I only could get enough money to get 1. And I was like, if I do this, I'm still not going to feel better. And the neighbor who was using said, look, bro, this is brand new needle. It's in the package. I just got it from the pharmacy. He's like, you don't have to worry about disease or anything like that. And that was sort of the first time I was like, all right, whatever. I don't want to be sick. And I used it that way. And as soon as you use it that way, you almost can't go back.
Jason, I just wanted to tell you that I appreciate your honesty when talking about this stuff, and I've always appreciated your honesty. It's clear that you've gotten some healing and some therapy from being able to talk about some of this stuff publicly and vulnerably.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
You're welcome. What do you remember about your mom being an ex-con and, you know, heroin addict? And you said heroin dealer, right?
Yeah. So it took me years to know that the reason she would disappear, and I'd live with my grandma. Then we'd live with her for a year, and then she'd relapse. Now I know, but I didn't know then. It was because she would start using again, and she'd run out of money. And then she couldn't take care of me and my sister, so we'd go move in with my grandma. And then we'd move in with my aunt because my grandma got too old. And then my aunt couldn't take care of me at one point because she got sick. and we went and lived with this random family. And then my mom got better. But what happened is at 12 years old, 13 years old, I was riding my bicycle to my buddy's. And she goes, hey, you know your brother's friend so-and-so? I don't want to say his name. He was a friend of my brother's. I had known him my whole life. My brother didn't live with me. It's such a... There's so much to it. But my brother was adopted at like 6 months old from my aunt. My aunt raised my brother, so he was in my life, but he didn't live with us. He didn't grow up with us. But I knew him, and he was my brother. So my brother used to hang out with this kid, and I knew that kid for years. And my mom said, hey, so-and-so owes me money. He's with his uncle. Will you drive this down, this bag? It was like a manila envelope. It was like a big one, like you would get contracts in or something. She's like, will you drive this down and give it to him? And he owes me money. I lent him money. Will you make sure he gives you such and such dollars? I was like, I don't want to, Mom. I'm going to my buddies, man. We're about to go play football. She's like, just do this for me real quick. And I was like, all right, whatever. And I drove my bicycle down to the beach, gave the person, because again, I knew him. He's like, hey, this is my Uncle Joey, blah, 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 whatever his name was. And I met his Uncle Joey. His Uncle Joey turned out to be an undercover cop. And I sold him heroin. So 2 months go by and they pick me up. My mom had been gone now. She disappeared. And I didn't know why for about a month. And I was living with my aunt at the time. My brother picked me up and said, hey, bro, you remember meeting so-and-so at the beach with his uncle? That was drugs. And you sold him drugs. And now they want to charge you for it unless your mom comes clean. Because they knew my mom was the one who gave it to me because she's the one who set it up over the phone with the guy. But I'm the one who physically handed it to him. So, and my mom knew that. My mom had a bad feeling, and she should have just said no. But she wanted to make the money, so that's why she sent me, because she figured it. Anyway, so about 2 months go by, and she calls to check in on me here and there. And then finally, the guy, like, said, look, it's been months. She needs to come clean, or we're going to charge you with this, and it'll be on your record forever. And we told her that, and that made her come back home and turn herself in. Then she went to jail, and I still loved her to death, of course, and I would go visit her there for, I think she did 5 years or more. And then eventually she realized, I guess she had had HIV, but it started to physically take a toll on her. And then she finally, like, told me when she got out of jail, they put her up in an apartment. She told me she had it. And that she was going to be in bad shape. And I moved in with her and started taking care of her. Cut to, you know, her getting worse and worse. And then after Jay and Bob, that's when we got home from making the movie Jay and Bob. About a week goes by and she passes away. And that's when I told you earlier in the story that I sort of lost it and lost 40 pounds or so in like a month. So, yeah, it was bad.
The story gets happier, though. So 9 years plus sober, and here you find yourself doing the Jay and Silent Bob reboot that is in theaters October 15th. Again, if you want to find theaters near you, go to fathomevents.com/reboot. Can you explain to us what made you guys decide to go reboot on this and go back to the old days?
That wasn't me at all. I wish I had the idea or whatever. Because honestly, I think this movie is super funny. Super clever, like Kevin is super clever at bringing back all these little tidbits of stuff from the old movies. Like in this movie, you would literally get little throwbacks to Clerks, Mallrats, Chasing Amy, Dogma, all the movies. There's little throwback jokes. Also, like Harley Quinn, his daughter, plays my daughter, but in the first movie, she played a young Silent Bob in front of the Quick Stop when it starts off with the F, mother, mother, F, mother, mother, F. That's her as a kid. Cut to, you know, years later, 18 years later, and now she's playing my daughter. And just all that type of, like, stuff. Just all these throwbacks. Super awesome. Super fun. But it was all Kevin's idea to call it a reboot and wrote the script and made it what it is, you know?
When fans shout at you, are they doing that song or are they doing Snoochie Boochies?
Oh, it's a little bit of everything, man. Boo Boo Kitty, I am the commander of the, you know, Snoochie Boochie, Snooch to the Nooch. But, you know, each person has their own little tidbit, so.
Jason, appreciate your time. Thank you for sharing your story with us, and congratulations on being sober for damn near a decade.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it, and you have a fantastic day.
You too.
Really enjoyed that conversation between Dan and Jason Mewes. Please go out and support Jay and Silent Bob Reboot in theaters October 15th. To find theaters near you, go to fathomevents.com/reboot. Next week on South Beach Sessions, Dan will be interviewing the always interesting Malcolm Gladwell. If you like what we're doing, please make sure to subscribe, rate, and review. You hear my voice mostly on The Mystery Crate, which is another great pod here on Levitard and Friends. Every week, you get a different type of episode. You never know what you're going to get week to week. We try to make it fun and keep you on your toes. I think you'd like it. Please go out and seek out Mystery Crate, presented by Levitard and Friends, on this very network. We think you'll like it. Dan, if you're a fan of Dan's here on South Beach Session, he often makes appearances there. We think you'll love it. Talk to you next week when Malcolm Gladwell joins Dan on South Beach Sessions.